Hello everyone and welcome to this Rural Building Blocks webinar offered by Praxis International and the Office on Violence Against Women. Building Blocks webinars feature the core components of effective institutional and individual advocacy that improve outcomes for victims and accountability for offenders. The trainings are intended to provide in-depth perspective and thinking on relevant issues from national and rural experts in the field. We're so glad that you could be with us today. My name is Liz Carlson. I'm a Praxis Program Specialist, and I facilitate these sessions each month. I'm joined by Matt Wiese, today's featured speaker. So welcome to you, Matt. Are you with us?
I'm with you.
Very good. Hi. I would like to further introduce today's topic, best practices for prosecution, and to further introduce Matt Wiese. Matt is a prosecuting attorney for Marquette County in Michigan, and Matt has about 20 years or so of experience in prosecution. Throughout his career, he has specialized in prosecuting domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, and other crimes of personal violence. He's been kind of a key participant in developing and promoting a countywide law enforcement domestic violence policy, which has been utilized throughout Marquette County since 1994, the Marquette County Law Enforcement Administrators Association in 1996, and the Marquette Women's Center in 2008. And so he brings a wealth of experience. He has contributed a tremendous amount to Praxis and all of the work that Praxis does nationally. And so we are always so grateful to have him join us. So welcome today, Matt. How are you? With that, I would say let's go ahead and get started with today's topic.
Okay. So I'm controlling the slides now, right?
That's right. You are.
Okay. So the first one is the poll question, and I wasn't sure how that would, just when they chat in, let us know who you are. Is that how we want that to happen?
No, right now we would ask each of you to, if you look in the left column, you will see the options A through D. A, you are a prosecutor in your CCR. B, you're a law enforcement officer. C, you're a community advocate. D, you're a systems advocate. Or you play another function in your CCR. So we would just ask you to make your selection A through D or chat in the other role that you play in your CCR. And we'll just pause for a quick moment as that pie chart is filling in. And it looks like of the selections that have been made, the bulk of our participants today, 54%, are prosecutors. And the next largest percentage of our participants are community advocates, with kind of the third place being systems advocates. So at this moment, at least, that's what the pie chart is telling us.
All right.
And there's some other chats. This is Marin. Hi. There's some other chats, too, about the other category. A DV state coalition, a coordinator of the local CERT team, legal advocate, other people playing multiple hats, which is common in rural communities of law enforcement, or maybe she has multiple people listening in with her law enforcement prosecution and CCR assistant, and an intern.
Good. All right. All right. Shall I begin, Liz?
Yeah, please.
Okay. So those of you out there, bear with me. It's my first time being the speaker on a webinar. So I'll try to keep up with the chat, and I'll try to remember to pause and allow for questions. And Marin, Liz or Marin, feel free to jump in if you need to. I'd like to go now to the next slide and talk about 8 different steps that I've kind of identified, not just myself, but working with others around the country, as to making victim safety a central feature of the criminal justice system's response. And the first thing I'd like to talk about is changing how we think about the violence in domestic violence cases and talk about the role specifically beginning with prosecutors and what we can do to assess for dangerousness. And number one is I think we need to work with law enforcement agencies to ask risk questions And make sure that we include this in how we document domestic violence cases, whether that's through standardized reports or in the police report narrative, and that we need to keep those risk factors in mind throughout the process as the case proceeds through the system. They should be followed up by prosecutors to identify additional information. We should, when we're meeting with victims, ask questions like, do you feel safe? Do you believe he will attempt to hurt you again? Make sure we use advocates to get victim input for assessing for dangerousness. Community-based and systems advocates can both work with the victim for identifying risk and safety planning, but it's imperative that victims have confidentiality. And it's important that both the system-based and the community-based advocates understand the roles and the difference between who is who you are working for, whereas system-based advocates work for the system, their obligation is to the system. And I think something should probably be put out there with whatever information is given to victims that the information shared with the systems-based advocate is not confidential. And so I think it's very important that those roles get defined and delineated, and it's important for a successful domestic violence program to have both systems-based and community-based advocates. They both serve important roles, but keep in mind that the community-based advocate is there, number one, to support the victim, and that the communication with a community-based or a nonprofit advocate is confidential. The other thing I think that we need to think about when we're trying to consider changing how we think about the violence is for prosecutors to understand the gender-specific nature of domestic violence as a crime. And I'm not suggesting that only men are prosecuted for domestic violence, but when we look at who batterers are, it's primarily men versus women, but there can be some women. And from a legal technical point of view, we know women can commit crimes of violence just like their male partners. However, the context for the use of women's violence in an intimate partner relationship is often different, often very different than when men use violence. Women generally use violence for different reasons, not because it's effective. So looking at context, we need to ask questions. If you're a prosecutor, especially, if a woman uses violence, why did she use violence? Was her use of violence effective? Did she use violence to control her partner? Some of those types of questions are good to figure out the context. Is it justice to prosecute a woman's use of violence in the same fashion as a man's use of violence in a domestic violence context? And what I'm getting at is, is the violence retaliation? Is the violence because that was her only option, because she never left? So look at the context and, you know, consider what is appropriate for the system response when a woman uses violence versus when a man uses violence, and under what circumstances. I think it's important for trial prosecutors who handle cases to develop a basic set of principles and values about the victim's role and the role of the criminal justice system. Try to incorporate these into protocols that the prosecution may have, law enforcement policies, into the coordinated community response. And at the core, the principle of victim safety should always be the foundation for everything else that we do. Some basic ideas or thoughts or principles that might be considered are the victim's participation in the criminal justice response to domestic violence is not necessarily in her best interests. I think if we remember that, and I have a hopefully a video, short video we're going to play in a little bit that will kind of emphasize that, to maybe keep in mind or ask, you know, see if this premise is true, which I believe it is, that a victim is not always safer when she leaves than when she stays. The criminal justice system response to domestic violence will not always provide safety from the batterer when the victim participates. The criminal justice system should not punish victims for choosing not to participate. And what are successful strategies for prosecution of domestic violence cases, including proceeding without victim participation? And what are successful prosecution strategies that are not based solely on the rate of conviction? So just some thoughts to put out there as you're thinking about the process, as you're thinking about what is going to be my system's response to this, to keep these things in mind, that participation by the victim is not always in her best interest, it doesn't always keep her safe, that the system, if it punishes victims, we're probably not inclined to hear from them again, and think about what successful strategies would look like, not based upon rate of conviction, but maybe it's based upon what type of intervention we can have so that the victim, we reduce the emphasis on the victim and try to make it safer for her as we process the case through the system. So as we do that, we have to think about the nonprofit community-based advocates, our systems-based advocates, the judges, the probation. We have to think about law enforcement and our police officers. And the police officers out there, I'm sure, you know, listening, understand, you know, when I'm talking about this, that it's way different from your response to how the case gets handled in the process. So police, judges, juries, probation officers, advocates, and even how victims think about domestic violence. So we need to constantly be refocusing on what we're trying to address here. And the number one thing is to keep victims safe and to hold offenders accountable. Anything, Liz, on that? Is there any questions about any of that or any comments?
No, not so far. That's really clear and thorough. That's great.
Okay. Number two, change how people act on cases. One thing that I've learned over the years is that the politics of the courthouse can be extremely lethal to creating a change in how people in the system act on cases. With an established operating structure and protocol, open criticism of other players in the system should be discouraged. A key function of having an interagency or coordinated community response is to look for gaps in your system. And when you find a gap in the system where something doesn't follow through or work as it should, that can often be perceived as a criticism. And so we need to be careful on when we're identifying gaps to look at it from more of an institutional approach. And I'll mention this a few times probably today. By institution, I mean a systematic approach and not focus on individuals or personalities. The nonprofit community-based program, I think, because it operates outside the system, is probably best positioned to house a coordinator if you're going to have a coordinator for your coordinated community response. And this can be controversial in some communities. I know that the community-based advocates don't always have a seat at the table. They may not always have an equal standing in collaborative efforts. You know, I used to joke that we have advocates that work in-house, and we would call those in-house advocates, such as the one that works for me in the prosecutor's office. And then we had community-based or outside advocates, which I would refer to as outhouse advocates, because they're sometimes treated like they are in the outhouse. So just to keep in mind that we need to work on those relations, and I think empowering your community-based advocacy program to not only have an equal share in any project, but also to, if you have a coordinator, have them based out of that, out of the community-based program. It's still important that we have interagency participation and that we all sit down, you know, whether it's two parts of the system or 20 parts of the system, but everybody has to identify what they do, what their roles are to address, you know, situations and try to produce better outcomes. I think prosecutors can play a very key role in this by trying to establish a culture that encourages rather than stifles change. And some examples of that is, rather than saying this is a bad police report or this police report sucks, the prosecutor in an interagency effort can say, how could this report be made better? How should a good police report look? What do officers need to produce better reports? What is being done elsewhere to improve the utility of police reports and prosecution? So rather than criticizing, look for ways that we can address systematic change to improve. Third is change how we network and communicate with each other. And traditionally, prosecutors, I've been around long enough that, you know, we really have a huge amount of discretion and autonomy in the system, and we often operated in what I would consider a decentralized system that allows total discretion and really no accountability. And with the advent of victims' rights over the last 20 years or so, and victims' rights being made part of the most states' constitution, and with the advent of coordinated community response to domestic violence programs and victims' rights and advocacy, prosecutors have had to become accountable to others in the system. And the prosecutors out there, I know that you probably know what I'm talking about. You have cases that are sensitive, and you have to be careful that we make sure that we get victim input and that we hear from the victims and that we still proceed with the case in a way that tries to take what their input into account, but still the community standards for what's expected of our jobs. So to facilitate accountability, pay attention to how we link to others in the system, identify how we can better share information for those who need that information to do their job. An example, I was in Montana in January, and we had a number of one-day conferences, and there was a big issue with how information gets shared and whether or not a community-based program could get the police report or be notified of a victim's name if there was an arrest. And those types of things need to be figured out. Most states have figured out a way to do this legally and share information. But again, it goes back to giving your community-based advocacy program an equal seat at the table, so to speak. The role of a prosecutor in shifting community norms, I think, is important. You know, publicly what we say and how we handle domestic violence cases. You know, as a prosecutor, how willing are we to try new methods of prosecuting cases that reduces the burden on the victim to testify? And I'm going to talk about some things that we've been doing lately that seem to have some success. How much does law enforcement rely upon us to make the effort they put into cases pay off? And I've seen this happen in my own community and others, where we say we have a program and we are very vigilant in making the police do all these steps and follow up and adopt new forms and new practices. But then if we don't follow through and prosecute a case in a way that allows for law enforcement to have input, that allows for law enforcement to let us know how they feel about the case, it can lead to a bad climate and bad relations between prosecutors and police. You know, look at who else relies on us to do our job. You know, how open are we to working with the community-based advocates, even if we have advocates inside our own shops? And basically, overall, incorporating community-based advocacy into the criminal justice response, it helps prosecutors better understand what's in the best interest of the victim. And, you know, just a quick example, when I was fairly green at this about 16, 17, 18 years ago, I can recall being very perturbed at my community-based advocate when they would show up in court with a hostile victim who did not want me to prosecute. And, you know, I felt like she was betraying this trust that we were trying to build with the community-based advocacy program when she would be there on the defendant's side with the victim when the victim did not want to participate in the criminal prosecution. And I think to get our heads wrapped around the idea that my role is different than their role, and respectfully and civilly understand each other's role, I think is important. And then afterwards to talk about those differences and why that might be so. Moving on to the next one. And I should probably move it along here.
Can I just pause for a quick question? A question mm-hmm. and then a comment from the chat. I wondered, how common is it for advocates to be housed in a prosecutor's office? And then there was just a chat comment, kind of appreciating what you had to say and appreciating that not all prosecutors are focused on coordinated community responses. And as a Batterers Intervention Program facilitator, this person, Kevin, wanted to thank all of the prosecutors on the call that were taking the time to be here. So that was
good.
The chat. But it just made me wonder how common it is that there are advocates that are housed within prosecutors' offices.
Community-based.
Yeah, community-based advocates right. that are housed in prosecutor's office. Do you have any sense?
Yeah, it's become more common, especially with OVW grants. But it's real important that there be almost a firewall or a Chinese wall, whatever the term is, where you don't have, where there's a clear delineation of what the roles and responsibilities are. There are programs that I've worked with that do have community-based advocates who are working for the community-based program housed within the prosecutor's office. And there are some bigger jurisdictions like San Diego that have family centers where they're, you know, it's everybody's in the same facility. But as long as, you know, like I said at the beginning, when we give out information to a domestic violence victim, we make sure that we let them know that information coming from our advocate is information that can and would be shared with the prosecutor. And that information they share with a community-based advocate is confidential unless they agree to let it be shared. So if I think if you cover those bases and make sure that we're clear on that, that it helps. In that, you know, crime victims and battered women and victims of domestic violence, they're not going to know all this stuff. So you have to really break it down for them so that they know who's who in the soup, so to speak.
Yeah. Right, that's good. That's helpful. Thanks, Matt.
Sure. And then on here, number four, developing written policies that include community-based advocacy programs. And I talk about four things here, basically. Vertical prosecution, working with your community-based advocates and what that looks like. Developing written policies that include community-based advocacy. And I think there's only three here, actually. And so for vertical prosecution, that's, I think everyone knows what that means, but basically a victim shows up at the prosecutor's office. How does she get there? Does she come in because she's upset? Does she come in because somebody made contact with her right away? The best practice, in my opinion, is for there to be a quick outreach to the victim within 24 hours so that she knows that there's somebody that would like to talk to her about the case. That could be even done with a screening call by your victim advocate that works in the prosecutor's office, that there be linkage with the community-based advocates so that they know about the case. Ideally, that linkage would happen with a law enforcement policy where the police have already reached out to the community-based program, ideally that night when an arrest has been made. Some programs have call-out advocates that come out to the victim and offer assistance and services on the spot. After there's been an arrest and once the situation is safe. Others, you know, they will fax or email a copy of the police report over. Some will just have their desk sergeants or whoever's at the station call, or the road patrol officer call over and say, hey, we've just arrested so-and-so, and here's the victim, and here's their contact information. But how that gets incorporated is very important, and when that victim comes into the prosecutor's office, that she doesn't get passed from one person to another. And in rural, I know some of the offices are bigger. For example, I have six attorneys in my office, including myself, so we're not that big. But if a victim has to talk to Prosecutor A and then go and talk to Prosecutor B, that can be frustrating, especially with personalities and information having to get all repeated. So if they can deal with one person when they come in and stay with that person, that's what I mean by vertical prosecution all the way through the process. And then working to make sure that those community-based advocates are brought into the mix, whether it's through law enforcement or whether it's through prosecutor practices or policies. And that's the third one there, is developing written policies that include the advocacy program. And how do you do that? And under, you know, what does that look like? It can take on various shapes and forms and look, you know, it can look different for your jurisdiction. One simple thing that we did 15 years ago when we were having complaints about police and advocates and prosecutors, you know, everyone seemed to be pointing the finger at everyone else. We basically put a spectrum as beginning to end of a case, you know, and of course it's law enforcement heavy at the beginning, and then it's advocacy involved and prosecution involved, and we just delineated the roles and responsibilities that each of us had and where they intersected in the system. In our policy, the police have to get a hold of the shelter and let them know. And then in our policy, the prosecutor's office gets a hold of the shelter and the community-based advocates and lets them know. So that if there's ever a complaint or a breakdown, you turn back to what you've agreed upon, whether you call it an MOU, whether you call it a practice, whether it's a written policy, but it's something you all agree on. And the only time you have a complaint that should be voiced is when it's an objective, something didn't happen that we said would happen. So we get away from this personality stuff, and we get away from this, what can naturally develop in these types of systems where the police don't like the advocate, or the advocate doesn't like this cop, or this prosecutor doesn't do whatever. So putting it down and agreeing upon it to have the best practice, and working with the basic three, which would be police, advocates, and prosecutors. Anything on that? I'm trying to watch the chat, but I'm not seeing anything come up.
No, there hasn't been any comments or questions the last few minutes, but this is a good opportunity to just remind you all that you are welcome to join in the conversation, and so don't be shy. If you have experiences in your own community that you would like to share with the group, or a particular question that you would like to make sure gets incorporated into the conversation, please utilize that chat. We will make a point of keeping an eye on it.
Thank you. This is a bit it's a little disconcerting. It's like when I pick a jury, you know, I ask them questions and they stare back at you and you don't know really. Here I'm talking into like an empty space, but I know you're out there. So anyway, I'm on the next slide, and creating direct confrontation of the offender, holding the offender accountable, you know, and how do we do that and what does that look like? One of my pet peeves is when we allow batterers to plead no contest, or if we allow their case to be diverted or supervised dismissal, you know, whatever the term is called in your jurisdiction. But first of all, a no contest plea doesn't require any admission. It's easy sometimes because then they don't have to admit to any wrongdoing, even though they're ultimately convicted, just as if they pled guilty. But I think if a batterer is going to go into the system and go into a batterer's intervention services program and truly try to make changes so that they don't continue with this behavior and come back or cause harm to women and children, the first step, you know, is acknowledgement for everything. So that's why I really try to get people not to accept no contest pleas. That's something that in my office we just say no to. Doing a supervised dismissal of a case where we don't take it through the process, but we divert it for other reasons. I think we need to have clear policies. If you're going to prosecute, you're going to prosecute, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, about what your position is. Do you have a no-drop policy? What does that mean? Do you, you know, have a pro-prosecution policy? What does that mean? But to just figure that out and make sure that the message is consistent. I know from personal experience over the years that defense attorneys, you know, in your jurisdiction, they know how you operate. They often tell their clients ahead of time, this is what you can probably expect here. And if they know that if you drag the case out long enough and cause the prosecution enough headaches that the prosecutor is probably going to fold their tent and go home, then they're going to advise their client of that. On the other hand, if they know you're going to hold firm, you're willing to take some chances, you're willing to push the case if you have to look for ways to prosecute, they'll advise their clients of that too. Number six, evaluate the intervention from the standpoint of how it impacts victims. This is a really difficult thing for those of us in the system to do. I used to keep a little folder of letters that I used to get from victims that would write me a letter and say, gee, you know, Mr. Prosecutor, you know, when I met with you, I wanted you to drop the case and you wouldn't, and now it's been 2-3 years later and I realize that you're right about that and I've moved on with my life and thank you for what you did. So I had these, you know, letters in this folder, and I used to talk about them a lot because I was proud of them. And then I was at some national conference once talking about this in front of a big audience, and an advocate, community-based advocate, raised her hand and she said, how many cases do you handle a year? And I said about 150 to 200 of domestic violence cases. And how many years you've been doing this? And we did the math and it came out to like 1,000 or more. And she goes, and how many letters do you have in this folder? And I had like 8 or 9. So she said, you really are using that as a measure for effectiveness? It's really not. And it kind of opened my eyes about that. And for me, some of the best ways to figure out how our intervention impacts victims is just to talk to them. You know, just to talk to them and make sure that you bring your community-based advocates in on that conversation. One thing that was real eye-opening for me is to go and sit in with permission and by invitation of a women's support group run by our local shelter. And they, you know, we had women in there whose cases never ended up resulting in an arrest, or they never got prosecuted, or they never reported it, or they did report it, and this was their experience. And just hearing their stories and what the impact of the system did on them made me think about that. And, you know, I was there to answer questions and address concerns and talk about the system, but I think that's real important for us to try to figure that out as best we can, because to us, we make these official pronouncements, or we take official action sometimes without really thinking about the impact that it's going to have upon a victim. And then trying to design the intervention in a way that addresses the harm that's done to children. As we all know, children are the next generation that's going to be either on our docket or not on our docket, and we hopefully don't want them on our docket. We want to send a message that, you know, if there's a father figure in the home that is committing domestic violence, that the children see that there was action that was taken. They were held accountable. We want to make sure that we don't drag children into court if we can avoid that. We want to make sure that the community has a supportive program for victims of domestic violence and their children. My shelter has a children's advocate for any child who's under the age of 14. And so they work with the kids on those cases, whether they're sexual assault or domestic violence victims or ancillary victims to domestic violence, because they were at the scene. And then finally, try to intervene in a way that does not cause more harm to victim safety. And, you know, I've heard lots of prosecutors talk about this over the years. And, you know, basically she has three choices. She can stay and endure it. She can leave or try to leave, or she can fight back. And we don't want to cause more harm to her. And, you know, the more I do this, the more I realize I don't really know what is the best approach. One simple thing that we used to do, for example, is we would say no condition of the bond, no contact condition as a condition of bond. And then we would have women come in and want that lifted, and we would say no. And we'd try to try to co-opt a plea agreement at that stage of the process. And, you know, I've had to back off on that a little bit and find out, why do you want the no-contact condition lifted? You know, it's really taking any power or any ability for her to have viable input by just saying no. Or, you know, we have a black and white rule. And I guess the bottom line here is that we can't really be black and white. We have to really look through the shades of gray and try to figure out what's the best approach, which takes time, which we don't always have. And I understand that. But trying to do what we can to get her input and give it validity is very important. So those are the first 8 steps, and I've really talked too much. So, Liz, I don't know if you can play the Rachel video at this point or not.
I will. I just wanted to pause for a moment. I wondered if you could clarify, and maybe this is just a question for me, but how would you make a distinction between a victim witness advocate and a community-based advocate?
A victim witness advocate or a prosecutor's advocate is somebody that works for the prosecutor's office. A community-based advocate is typically somebody that works for your nonprofit community-based domestic violence shelter, your women's program, your sexual assault program in the community. So that's the distinction, is one does not work for the criminal justice system. They work for the interest of helping victims, whether they're sexual assault or domestic violence victims.
Good. That's a good clarification.
Should I set this up real quick?
Well, there's a couple of other things. Let's see. So if I can backtrack a little bit in the chat. There was a first comment, I think, to number 5, when you were talking about no contest pleas.
Yep.
And there was a comment saying that they are a problem relative to, for BIP groups, no contest is problematic. And so then Kevin Weir went on to say that he's located not far away from Marquette in Houghton. Can you see this comment, Matt?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so I'm just going to kind of proceed in case there's anybody that's not able to read this chat. Fortunately, for his group, there haven't been very many no contests that they've had to deal with. The batter will let everyone in the group know that he pled no contest. This allows the batter to stand apart, not only from the group, but also from his actions. In a nutshell, it gets in the way of the batter doing work, and it begins to chip away at the group cohesion.
Okay, yes.
And then there were a couple of other comments that people were kind of also talking about experiences.
Well, that's a good example of how the no contest plea, you know, the problem trickles on throughout the process. And I think that's a good comment, and it reinforces. And somebody said they couldn't hear me that well. I'm sorry about that. I'll speak up. We're going to try to play a video here shortly. It's called The Story of Rachel, and it was actually this is an actual woman, and these are all the experiences that she had as she went through the system. It's about a 4-minute long video, and I think it's important, if it plays well, for people to just sit back and watch it, because it's pretty impactful, and it really drives the point home, especially for those of us that don't work, that are those of us in the system, because we don't really realize the impact of a case going through the criminal justice system on a person who's out there dealing with it.
All right. So with that, I will set this up. We are going to see how it goes.
All right, your turn, Portia. Come on, guys.
Mom, can we play till I win?
Audrey, it's been so crazy around here.
Girl, what did he do now?
Girl, I did it. I called the police on his ass, and they took him out of here.
Oh, my goodness.
Mom, I got into the band. Miss Peter said I'm good enough to play the violin.
Mommy is so proud of you. I just want you to know that. I knew you could do it.
Hey, what do you think we should do for Mom's birthday? How about a surprise party? That'd be a great one.
Mom, when is Dad coming back? I hope he's here for Christmas.
Daryl, are you ready to go?
Baby, you know I didn't mean to do that. You know how much you and the kids mean to me. What can I do to make
this No. Calvin, I've heard it too many times before.
Mom, those people are at the door again.
Oh. All right, just tell them I'll be down there. Just go downstairs and wait. I'm on my way.
What did you do? Why do these people tell me I can't see my kids? Now, you're going to pay for this. Rachel, you listening to me?
Mom, can I have a friend over tomorrow?
Portia, I don't know, okay?
But, Mom...
I'm very busy.
Derek got to have a friend over last week.
Ms. Williams, I'm calling to inform you that you're past due on your phone bill. Would you be able to make a payment by the 30th?
I don't know. I really don't know. Hey. Don't cry. Hush. Listen, those kids don't know anything about you. You are a wonderful child. You are a beautiful girl.
Hey, Mom, Pastor Foy called. He wants to know if we can sing at church. I told him we will.
But Daryl, ugh.
Mom, don't forget I have basketball practice after school.
I won't forget, Portia. I would never forget. When is it?
Mom, I don't feel good.
You don't feel good like what?
Don't hang up. Just let me tell you. Hey, the last time I talked to you, I was just really upset. Just, you know, let's just work this thing out.
Calvin, no. It doesn't work like that, okay? Audrey, I do not know what I'm going to do. Girl, they are evicting me. I mean, I won't have a place to live. Girl, what am I supposed to tell my kids?
I know y'all miss me, right? Is Mom taking good care of y'all? Now, you know I'm going to be home as soon as I can, but it's up to your mom.
Mom, when is Dad coming home?
I don't think Dad will be coming back home, honey.
He wants to come home, but he says he won't let him.
Oh, baby.
Mom, I aced my spelling test. Can we go shopping? Mom, can you tell Derry to get out of my space?
She started it.
Did not.
Did too.
Stop it.
So the if you followed the thread and saw the various, like the spider webs of where this whole thing went, and then the case note at the end that Rachel is becoming increasingly more uncooperative, I mean, it's no wonder. And that wasn't made up. That wasn't some fictional account. That was one woman's story. I believe she's out of Duluth. Is that right, Liz?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that can be impactful when we think about things, and you know, that might be something you may want to show to your folks you're working with if you want to try to coordinate with them on how you can have a better response. The next slide just kind of recaps some of the things that I was talking about, is, you know, looking at the distinct and collaborative roles of the system-based, community-based advocate. And I'm talking about the people that work for your safe house, your woman's center, whatever the program is called in your community, versus the and how you can work with them in your system to enhance prosecution. And you know, a written policy is a good way to do it that's signed off on by your shelter program, your community-based program, and by your prosecutor. I've signed ours, and ideally by all the chiefs of police in your jurisdiction, so that everyone has agreed that this is the approach we're going to take. Something simple as an MOU, a Memorandum of Understanding, that when there's an arrest, this information will be provided. When there's a charge issued, we will do the following things to work with our community-based program. Having standardized practices such as automatically getting them the information of when a victim is going to be meeting with a prosecutor so they can participate. Making sure there's a standardized practice for getting them the police report. Those types of things. Are there standardized forms that we use? We've created a form for our prosecution advocate, who I call the victim witness advocate. When she does the initial screening call the next day with the victim, she uses a form that is pretty standard about, you know, the history of violence. Do you feel safe? What would you like to see done? Has he been to treatment before? You know, and usually that one-page form can really give me a pretty good snapshot as to how this case is going to go and what the victim's concerns are. Implementing an institutional change. Years ago, we had this battle with the court on you know, bond conditions and standardizing bond conditions, and how did we go about doing that? And we found out that the information from the police to the prosecutor to the judge or magistrate wasn't flowing smoothly, and they weren't getting the same information. So I would be asking, you know, why didn't they have a higher bond, or why weren't there more conditions, et cetera? Well, they weren't getting the information. So that was an institutional change that we implemented by creating some simple forms to make sure that that information, when the bond review happened, got before the judge or magistrate. And then again, like I mentioned before, focus on the process, not personalities. It'd be great if we all liked each other really well and we all got along superbly, but that's not the real world. There's, you know, personality differences. So focus on the process, not people. Plus, the other thing is, if you have a very good program that's in large part very good because you have a strong person, if that strong person leaves, then you've not created an institutional change. It was done well because you had a good person doing the job, and we want everyone to do the job well. The next slide is how prosecutors work with law enforcement and advocacy agencies to enhance safety for women while holding offenders accountable. Identifying key practices that are to be achieved. What are the key practices that you want to achieve? Every time there's an arrest, you know, do they stay in jail till they're brought in for an arraignment? How does that review happen? Is there an automatic referral to the community-based program? Make sure that there's consistent messages there, that your police aren't telling the victim something different than your prosecutor is telling the victim, or that the police aren't telling the defendant when they arrest him one thing and then the prosecutor says something different to the defense attorney, which creates inconsistency, which they'll identify and exploit. What are the roles and responsibilities that we each have? You know, and I'm pretty confident in my community now that if we get a conviction, I know that the person's going to go to a well-established batterers intervention service program that follows the standards that we've set up in Michigan. So, you know, I know that that's going to happen, but that didn't always happen that way. And I know that the police are almost all the time going to make an arrest if they have probable cause. And I know that we're not going to give a no contest plea. So what we do in each of our roles in the system, you know, incorporate community-based advocates at every step of this process if you can. And, you know, I've harped on this all the last hour, but don't compromise the integrity of community-based advocates. You know, they have a tough job, and they're often treated like they're not, you know, they're not really equals. Any comments on that? Move on.
Nope, not so far. Nope.
Okay. So some examples, key practices in prosecution charging decisions. There's a list here. I won't just read it to you, but, you know, request and consider a wide range of information. Look at the history, harm to children. Two in red there are risk and lethality factors and evaluate prior incidents and convictions. These are the things that we try to look at when we're evaluating a case as a prosecutor. We've even gone and issued on old cases that were still within the statute of limitations. If you're going to decline a case, what are some of the other options that you want to put out there? Is there going to be an automatic referral, some sort of a check to make sure that the advocacy program was communicated with so they're aware that this person is out there? Make sure that we communicate charging decisions and respond to inquiries. I think that last one is probably one of the biggest ones that we have to me, that have come back to haunt me, is if you don't clearly communicate why you've made the decisions you've made, both to the police and to victims' advocates, that'll come back. You know, sometimes you just have to make a tough call and be straight up about it, and here's why I can or cannot do that. And most of the time, taking the time to explain this to somebody really is beneficial in the long run. It can come back to bite you in the butt, and it has on occasion, but it's better than just saying, I'm not going to talk to you about this, I made my decision. Key practices to evaluate risk and lethality factors. You've all probably seen these, but how do you incorporate them into your response for law enforcement, for your evaluation of a case as a prosecutor, so that we're all on the same page? We all see these things, and we all know that there are factors that we need to keep an eye out on, that we know that everybody who has exhibited lethality factors like this doesn't go and become lethal or kill, but we often know that the ones that do become lethal, they're often the ones that do kill. When we look back, we see these factors that are present. So we just have to be aware. And I think saying that these things are here, so telling the victim that, you know, she's going to get killed might be a little overreach, but being aware that they're there and hearing what she has to say about them, and especially the strangulation, and then looking at strangulation laws, if you have one, or if you don't, looking at the assault laws, because strangulation in most jurisdictions will be an enhanced felony. In Michigan, it's now a 10-year felony, but most states have some sort of a great bodily harm statute for under which you could charge a strangulation charge if you think it's appropriate.
Can I just, before we go on to the next slide, I'm going to back us up, because there was a question in the chat that I think pertains a little bit to what you're talking about in this slide. And so Teresa Eisenman asked a question. She says, in North Dakota, we have multiple different kinds of no contact or protection orders. In some of them, the victim requests, while others are requested by prosecutors. Do you have any thoughts on treating them differently when a victim requests that the order be lifted?
I can certainly. Number one, there's two types of no contact orders, basically. One is the system-imposed one as a condition of the case or a condition of bond, and the other is, you know, the personal protection order, restraining order. So if somebody is a victim of domestic violence and there's no criminal case, they can go get a protection order. And that's theirs to have or to drop or not drop. The thing about the no contact orders with a criminal case is that if they're standardized and implemented on every case, the victim may not have asked for it. So that's why I think it's very important that there be an assessment right away to talk to the victim and get her input as to this no contact condition. In some jurisdictions, you may have farms, you may have ranches, you may have a family business. You may need to have contact, and the context for which the violence happened may be different from the context for which they're trying to run their lives, or someone watched the kids because someone works a different shift than the other person. So you have to be flexible and get victim input right away if your system's putting a no-contact condition in place, which is like a restraining order, and be willing to ask the court to modify that or be willing to get the victim access to the judge so that she can ask for it. Does that answer the question, I hope?
Yeah, Teresa, if you have more clarification that you would like, go ahead and chat that into the box. She's saying that's great.
Yep.
Thank you. Thanks for that.
An example for a key practice to evaluate prior incidents and convictions. When you're reviewing a report or review prior recent incidents and charge them, if there's sufficient evidence, if it's against the same victim, against another victim, look at the prior convictions to determine possible enhancements. You know, could this be charged as a second or third offense if you have that in your state to make it a more serious crime? I've actually prosecuted quite a few domestic violence cases to a jury trial, and it was one of the strange phenomenons was other victims of the defendant would show up at the trial. I always found that to be a very interesting thing, that they would show up because they want to see what's going to happen to him because they went through the same garbage with him historically. And utilizing them, you might be able they might be able to be a witness if they're willing or able. It could produce what's called other acts evidence that you could use in a case. Moving on, how to build a case that reduces reliance on battered woman's testimony in the aftermath of Crawford. For the prosecutors in the webinar, I think everyone knows what forfeiture of your confrontation rights are by wrongdoing. But in essence, after Crawford, we weren't able to use the hearsay exceptions that we used to use. And what we're talking about are the excited utterances, the present sense impressions, anything that is elicited through question and answer by the police as testimonial type of stuff. So we used to be able to have the police officers come to court and testify to what she said happened. So now we can't do that after the Washington versus Crawford decision by the U.S. Supreme Court because of the Confrontation Clause. So number one, what I always do is try to find out if the defendant has had any contact with her and done any wrongdoing to try to harass her, intimidate her, or tamper with her ability to come to court and testify. The number one area where you can get this type of information is by pulling jail phone recordings or jail visitation recordings if they're recorded. These are a treasure trove of information. It's very mundane and it's very arduous to go through all this, but if you find out that somebody's tampering with your domestic violence victim, then you can ask the court to forfeit their right of confrontation because of their wrongdoing. The other thing that we've been doing recently in Michigan is that we've been having a little more critical analysis of the Fifth Amendment right to confrontation, and it requires production of the witness. It doesn't require that the witness testify how you want them to. So, for example, if she says to the police on the night in question, all these things happened to her, and she was excited or upset or crying about it, or it was shortly after the incident happened, I still want the police to document that, because if she does not, if it's a case that we're going to go to trial on and she cannot go to court and testify for whatever reason, if you still produce her and she does not testify like you would want her to, then you've satisfied the Confrontation Clause. And there's some case law on this, and most states, I think, if you do some research, you'll find there's case law on this. And then you can ask the judge to proceed with admission of the excited utterances and the other hearsay statements that may have been made to the police. So once they're produced, hearsay statements should be admissible. And then the other thing that we always train our law enforcement on is to always find out when they're investigating the incident the night it happened, is to find out if she spoke to anyone else about it. Usually she will have spoken to her, you know, a friend, a mother, a sister, an aunt, somebody, and quite often before she even calls 911. And those statements that were made to a non-police witness would be admissible also. And so at the end here, I say balance victim safety vis-a-vis offender accountability. It's one of the only areas in criminal law that I'm aware of where we have serious crime and we may not have a victim who wants to or who is able to participate. And, you know, that's a tough call to make, but I think we need to hold the offender accountable. And if we can take the onus or the focus off of the victim and put it onto the system like we used to do, and just reiterate that message that defendants do understand that, and they can understand that. Okay. So basically, what I'm saying is the old-fashioned way. When I say old-fashioned, I'm talking 15 years ago when we were, well, many of us who were around were prosecuting cases without production of the domestic violence victim. That's by building a complete and thorough case through investigation and accurately recording the nature and circumstances of what happened by gathering all the witness statements and documenting all the evidence. So reviewing policy, you know, what are the underlying principles, philosophy, what are your criteria, and then monitor. A policy is only so good if you monitor and support compliance and review and amend. And I'm guilty of that, like so many. You get a policy and then you say, okay, it's good, and then before you know it, it's 5-6 years later and things have changed. Practices change, procedures change, so it's important to look at that. And we're actually going through that process in Marquette County right now. So some of the things to look at are interagency approach with collaborative and collective intervention goals, attention to the context and severity of the abuse, recognizing that most domestic violence is a pattern crime requiring continued engagement, seeking swift and sure consequences, is always effective in my opinion. Trying to make sure that there's messages of help and accountability. You know, you're going to get frustrated with a domestic violence victim that will not cooperate with you, but it doesn't do you or her any good to get angry with her. It's, I believe, always much better to say, look, we're here. If something happens, I want you to know you can call again. I want you to know that we're here when you're ready. And try to reduce unintended consequences and disparity of impact. And that's where I'm talking about maybe you have to have a case-by-case review on a bond condition of no contact. Or you have a case-by-case review as to are you going to take this case to trial or not if your victim is non-participating because she can't or won't or refuses to. So you get a policy and you have to decide. You know, I've heard so many places say we have a zero tolerance policy or we have a no drop policy. You have to define that. I know that San Diego City had a policy of no drop, but they didn't charge every case. They only charged the cases they knew they could win. Whereas Chicago had a policy of pro prosecution, but they charged thousands of cases and dismissed thousands of cases. So you have to define, you know, how big of a net are you going to cast, and what does it mean when you say we're going to do this? And, you know, have some tangible things, like if there are injuries that required medical treatment, we're not going to drop that case. If they have a prior history, we're not going to drop that case. I mean, it always comes down to the eve of trial, and you're saying, well, we can't go to court because we can't prove it. If you can't prove it, you just can't prove it. But looking at these factors that are listed here, are some of the common things that you can consider. And this is not an all-inclusive list by any means. So the other example is our county DA has a no-drop policy. No-drop means prosecutors should pursue cases for which there's strong evidence, even when victims refuse to cooperate. Well, there's no shall there. It's a should. Again, it's a judgment call. So looking at each case and deciding, you know, can we go forward or can't we go forward? I know of lots of examples where one prosecutor will say no, another prosecutor will say yes, and you go forward and you get a conviction. Well, had it been prosecutor A who made that call, the case would not have gone forward. You know, it's a very subjective process, but by looking at each case and making a decision, you can kind of massage how your approach. Historically, we did not have a lot of luck prosecuting he said, she said sexual assault cases. And there was a period of time where this office did not prosecute them. And then when I became the elected prosecutor, I started prosecuting some of those cases, and I lost some, but we started winning more and more of them. And, you know, I think you just have to be willing to take the risk and take the attempt to go forward. Again, criteria and procedures that for evaluating the case, there's a list of things here, and I'm getting short on time, so I wanted to make sure I covered everything, but you want to decrease reliance on memory. You'll want to account for how victims use violence, recognize and guard against retaliation by offenders toward victims. Make sure that you document the pattern of abuse in the history. And these are pretty much repeated from other things I've said earlier, but reinforce swift, timely response. Recognize batterers use children to control victims, and that the adult victim parent is critical to the welfare of the children. And I think the Rachel video really, really brings that home. And make sure that the victim is always notified and that there's advocacy available for her, and that regardless of the message you have to give her, whether it's good or bad, that you give it to her straight up and don't try to avoid her. I think being honest is always the best policy, and dealing with tough conversations. For monitoring and compliance, you know, you look at the system and where does the system link up? You know, I talked about gaps earlier. Where are the gaps? The gaps are where you can create links. You know, how does the system link, you know, from police to prosecution to prosecutor advocate to community-based advocate to the court system to probation to batterers intervention services, and is it being effective? Specify the how, when, and with whom for information sharing. I tend to believe in open information sharing, and I know there's been problems in jurisdictions that don't do that. And resistance to do that. But the more that information is shared, I think the better your response can be. Tracking practitioner compliance, and if there's an exception, you know, understanding why exceptions were made, ensuring compliance and address noncompliance as to why a case went or didn't go, continue education and training, and establish a process of record sharing. I think record sharing is critical. I think your shelter should know, your police should know, you should know if you don't, and I think the public should know. And you can give the public a snapshot as to what things look like in the community every year, and your local media will be happy to do a story, whether it's in print media or on television, as to here's what we have going on in our jurisdiction and what we're trying to accomplish. And it sends a message out there that you're taking this crime seriously. There, I made it.
You did, almost on the dot. That was perfect. That was perfect. Although I should say we do still have a moment or two. If there's any question that anybody would like to chat in, please, now is the time to do that. And I would like to, of course, say thank you so much to Matt. That was very well-timed and cohesive and comprehensive. Thanks so much for that.
Well, thank you.
And so just a couple of things I would say. Next month will be a little bit of a companion to the training today, this building block session today. I hope that you all will be able to join us in our conversation. Next month, August 20th, will be our informal rural routes to change conversation with Rose Thielen, and the session will be addressing prosecution response to battering through a CCR. So a similar topic, but the conversation will be addressed in a little different way. It will be a dialogue between Rose and a rural grantee in consideration of prosecution practices that are happening within a rural community, a CCR, a kind of looking exactly at what is happening within a particular community. So we hope that you all will be able to join us for that conversation next month. And you should have all hopefully seen in the chat the resources to the story of Rachel, as well as the practitioner's guide to risk and danger. If you would like to have me email those resources to you, the links to those directly, you can send an email to liz@praxisinternational.org. Or if you have any follow-up questions that you would like to send to Matt from today's session, you'll see his email on the webinar right now, mwiese, that's M-W-I-E-S-E at mqtco.org. That's his work email. And if you have a little question or clarification, I think Matt is open to following up with you on that. Right, Matt?
Absolutely.
I'm kind of putting you on the spot. What else can you say? But
well, I knew it was on the spot, so it's
right.
Not like it's a secret.
That's true. So anyway, thank you all of you for participating today. We appreciate having your company and your comments. And just know that when you disconnect from this session, you will be routed to a very brief evaluation of this session. And we always rely on your comments. So don't be shy. Be sure to let us know what your thoughts are about this session and ideas that you have about future sessions. So thank you, everybody. Take good care. Thank you so much, Matt. And
thanks, Liz.
Have a summer, everybody.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye.
Bye.